This is ContactTalkRadio.com, consciousness in action, and you are taking action into your consciousness by tuning into Contact Talk Radio.
And on TuneIn.com, Hing.fm, and Upsnap Mobile.
Contact Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Dr. Madeira Show, where he will discuss testosterone optimization and full body health for the high-performance modern man. Now, here's your host, Dr. Madeira.
Hello, everybody. It's Dr. Madeira back on my show today, and we have Dr. Lauren Tessier here as a guest, naturopathic doctor in Vermont. How's it going today, Dr. Lauren?
Oh, it's gone awesome. Thanks for asking. How are you?
Doing great here and excited to interview you about mold, mycotoxins, and mold illness, which is your specialty. And just for the audience, how did you get into working with mold, mycotoxins with patients?
Yeah, that's a great question. Lots of different reasons why. One of the main one was when I landed in Vermont, doing mostly primary care, there's a lot of cases of chronic recurrent fatigue and brain fog and all those issues that really weren't responding to treatment with traditional naturopathic methods. Turns out that the area I moved to in Vermont was hit by Hurricane Irene 2 years prior in 2011. And so a lot of what I was seeing was fallout from water damage in these homes. So that kind of opened up the realm and the question of, you know, is mold an impact in these cases? And then kind of the fuel that's been added to my fire to, you know, go forward and move forward is, you know, my own battles with mold exposure and, you know, familial exposures that were really heart-wrenching and upsetting. And, you know, I think we have our first thing that kind of brings our attention to it. And then we have numerous reasons that always kind of come that encourage us along that path. So.
Yeah, spectacular. I mean, it's good. It's good that you've had, I think, personal experience, although challenging and, as you said, heartbreaking, really brings great wisdom to your practice as a practitioner in this specialty. And there's really a not many people talking about mold. I mean, there are some, but it seems like even today, there's so much mythology that people believe about mold toxins and think, oh yeah, there's, you know, no mold in, you know, Arizona, or there's no mold in this dry climate or this dry time of year because I can't see it, or, you know, we used bleach and we scrubbed it away and it's no big deal now, or they just ripped that part of the house out and maybe they didn't get all the mold. So people are still having symptoms, maybe even after they got out of that environment. And I think a lot of patients that I talk to are kind of skeptical of why they would need to get a mold mycotoxin test or have their home tested. And I think I was there not too long ago myself thinking, well, why do I need to do a mold test in my home when, you know, I'm not smelling it, I can't see it right now, and, you know, why do I need to spend that money there? So maybe we can highlight some of the key symptoms or disease conditions that people might check off on any doctor's intake form that could be related to mold that you see over and over again that are, you know, the central mold infection symptoms.
Yeah. So I think in wrapping your head around that, I think before you kind of do any of that, it's a really good idea to understand the different ways in which mold can interact and manifest with the body. And so really simple concept, kind of broken down to the Venn diagram of our childhoods, right? We would have four overlapping circles. One would be fungal allergy, which is the one that's like most common, most widely accepted. The next would be fungal infection, which is in Western medicine a lot more rare, but kind of with the subtext of colonization too. Colonization, a little bit debatable for some, but we do have a mycobiome, right? Fungal natural flora in our body. So we have allergy, we have the presence of fungus in the body, whether that's a colonization or an infection. We have mycotoxicosis, which is the toxic state that is induced by mold exposure. And then we have SIRS, which is this chronic inflammatory response syndrome, where the body just kind of starts producing inflammation that just won't quit in response to quite a few different things that can perturb it. And one of them is mold, right? So if you understand that those are the four major ones, then you can kind of grasp that this picture kind of looks like this, this one looks like this, and then you can understand that they have some overlap. So when I'm thinking about like a mycotoxic picture, I think of a lot of neurological and endocrine issues, because mycotoxins are lipophilic. They cross into and out of cells easily. They hang out in our fatty tissues, deposition in fatty tissues, and our nervous system is mostly fatty tissue, right? And then you see a lot of issues around hormonal imbalance with mycotoxic issues. So if you're kind of stepping back and panning out and thinking about what that looks like clinically, you're going to think of like numbness, tingling, fatigue, brain fog, kind of electrical pain, internal vibrating sensation, hearing loss, visual discrepancies, whether that's with color, which I've seen a good amount, and also with contrast, imbalance, issues with walking. I've even seen some kind of borderline seizure activity that's really not diagnosable in a seizure realm, but still presents as such. And then we see some of the endocrine stuff with mycotoxicosis, which is, you know, the low libido, altered weight due to leptin resistance, muscle mass issues, sleep issues, you name it, changes in menses, even breast bud development. We can, there's a lot going on with the mycotoxin picture. So that's kind of the major symptoms I see. I see a lot of mycotoxin pictures, but then you see a lot of SIRS pictures, which has the fatigue and kind of all the neuro stuff, but then there's a whole other added level of immune system dysregulation. And, you know, you're going to see that with like chronic infections, joint pain, fever, dysregulation stuff, just kind of all over the place on that front. And then, you know, our allergy symptoms are pretty normal allergic picture, our atopic triad, our eczema, our rhinitis, all of that kind of stuff. And then fungal infection could essentially look like all of them. You could have someone who has kind of a histamine reaction to the mold in their body, and therefore they have a little bit of an allergic picture. They could have a toxic reaction to the mold in their body, and therefore they have more of a mycotoxin picture, or they have a SIRS picture because of the mold in their body. So, depending on how the case presents to you and depending on what you're suspect of, you might kind of lump one type of symptom more into one category than another. So, but the biggest ones hands down in my practice are the fatigue and the brain fog. Nearly every case has that complaint, which that's usually something that's reassuring for people to hear, because they've done everything. They've tried everything, and they come into me and I go, oh no, that's normal. And they're like, oh my gosh, thank God.
And when they come to see you, have they already had certain things worked up, like blood tests for thyroid, adrenals, reproductive hormones, and see deficits or deficiencies in those areas too, that would kind of earmark the fatigue category in the endocrine section?
So I usually have, usually by the time people have come to me, just because of the name of my practice, it's like Life After Mold. A lot of people are coming to me already suspect mold. And so they've already gone through all their doctors. They've already, you know, done everything. And most of them have already gone to numerous Lyme doctors thinking that the mold is actually a Lyme disease picture. So, you know, a lot of the normal fatigue things that we'd see have already been worked up with, yeah, the adrenals, the hormones, the nutritional deficiencies. But it's interesting because there's even some mechanisms where we see that mold exposure can worsen or exacerbate some of those nutritional deficits. So usually I have people work up the most obvious or the most concerning rollouts before we dive all in on the mold.
Gotcha. Okay. And with mold testing, are you a big proponent of getting home mold testing and a urine mycotoxin mold test from Great Plains Labs, or how do you like to diagnose?
Yeah. So I definitely take a full intake with people. When I'm working my kind of, I don't want to call it a protocol because protocol pigeonholes people. I have kind of a structure or an outline that I follow that helps me with roll-ins and roll-outs. It's more of an algorithm rather than a protocol. But usually the first pass is ruling out mycotoxicosis or addressing it. So usually we are doing some type of urine mycotoxin test. I have a preference towards the ELISA methodology rather than the liquid chromatography methodology. It's not that one is inherently bad or the other. It's just that one may potentially answer a slightly different clinical question. And so we can talk a little about that later if you'd like. And so I usually use urine mycotoxin testing after I've provoked people, but usually the people I'm seeing come in are so sensitive that that provocation that we usually know about with like glutathione, they can't tolerate it. So there's this whole putting on the oven mitts, as I like to say, of like even working up towards provoking people to test. So sometimes there's a bit of a pre-treatment that occurs before we do that testing. But during that time, it also gives us the opportunity to take a look at what their true exposures are, you know, in their home, in their car, and in their office.
That's a good point about the car, because you mentioned already water-damaged homes being a big cause of mold infections for people and mold illness. How often are you seeing water-damaged cars or cars that have dampness over time in them, whether it's from someone putting their snowboard in the back of their car without a mat down or for a year or two, or actual, you know, poor sealant in the car and they're actually water or snow melt getting into a car being parked outdoors or something?
You know, it's always the wild card. I ask about it on every single one of my intakes with people. And a lot of the times, you know, the answer will be my car's clean, it's well maintained, or, you know, they'll give me the status. But there's been a couple of cases that I've had where they haven't gotten better. And they finally put two and two together that when they're in their car, they get lightheaded, dizziness, shortness of breath. So sometimes the car is the wild card. And every now and then you'll see like class action lawsuits against different types of cars because molds have been found in the vents. Usually when there's a mold issue in a car, I haven't necessarily seen it as a result of things that go into storage in the car. It's usually some manufacturer error or a gasket is leaking or, you know, there's some type of contamination with the air filter. It's very rarely like the snowboard that has like a half a cup of water that's just going to dissipate anyway, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really helpful. I think for the listeners to understand that even if their home is clear, that there can be, as you say, that wild card out there. And you know, if they're having symptoms after being in their car or right when they get into their car, recognizing it. On a similar note, what is your thought process around foods and beverages? What are some key foods and beverages that people should avoid? Even let's say someone's listening to this and they don't have severe brain fog on a regular basis or extreme fatigue on a regular basis, but they like certain foods that may have mold in them. What would be some key things for them to avoid or switch out with something else?
Yeah, you know, I think in general, the mold realm with food is a very difficult thing to navigate and dialogue with people about. When I originally started in this field, I was only CSRS trained, and then obviously I've garnered a lot more knowledge. And, you know, CSRS really, CSRS training, Shoemaker Protocol training, really it infers that food is not an issue. Now, after I've done my own literature and my own digging and all of these things, you start to realize that there's mycotoxins in all of our food system. And we have some of the lowest standards of protection compared to some developing nations across the world. And so there is the potential that if you eat enough of something, you could pass the normal daily limits. Because what happens is they'll put a big pile of oats and they'll test the oats to see how many, like how much mycotoxin per pound or something. And if there is too much, then they dilute it essentially with clean oats. So that way they hit their maximum threshold. So it's expected that you will eat X amount with what you're consuming if it's pushing up against its limits. And if you're eating a lot of these things, you can pass your safety daily limits. We see it a lot of food safety surveys from around the world that really demonstrate kids who are eating a lot of grains and developing nations are just like bombarding their body with mycotoxins. Now, the hard part is that usually we say foods that have been stored. So we're thinking of like peanuts and grains and legumes and anything dried. But then we have to go a step further into what about the things that are fermented? And then we go a step further to what about animals and the fact that animals are provided grain that potentially have contaminated feed and they bioaccumulate. There's been studies of premature breast bud development in different areas around the country, around the world, excuse me, in various countries with kids who were eating a lot of dairy and meat products that were contaminated with a particular anabolic mycotoxin that was leading to this like precocious puberty and breast bud development and all this stuff. So, you know, it's a hard thing to navigate because probably the cleanest thing that you can eat in your diet is freshly harvested vegetables that are well washed. If that's going to give you the least amount of exposure. One of the other curious findings from a study that I think either came out in 2019, 2018, I just posted about it, was that baby cereals, organic baby cereals, actually have a higher rate of DON, also known as vomitoxin, than non-organic cereals, which, you know, If anyone's concerned about these things out there, it's really the proof that you have to pick your battles. You know, if it's non-organic, then it's glyphosate and GMO. But apparently, if it is organic, they're not using pesticides, they're not using fungicides, you would think. So there's higher mycotoxins. So it's really a hard balance with food because your exposure is there and it's like, well, what are you going to eat? And so the thing I remind people too is that food is something that's supposed to sustain us. It's supposed to give us life. It's supposed to bring people together. It in some cases imparts joy for people. You know, it's something to be celebrated. And we walk a very dangerous line when we stigmatize food. And then also, a lot of people who are so sick and they don't have the energy to appropriately feed themselves or take care of themselves, you tell them this whole list of what they can't eat, you know, are they might not, they might choose to skip a meal. And, you know, in some cases, not eating can be problematic to recovery too. So food is a really big thing to unwrap in the mycotoxin world. If people just want the straight and the clean and the cut, you know, I would have to say avoid meats, avoid grains, beans, legumes, and just eat fresh veggies and fresh fruits that are really well washed.
Okay. And what about coffee?
Coffee. You know, I love coffee, and that's probably the one place that I've been for people. I'm like, if you want that dang cup of coffee, drink the dang cup of coffee. If it brings you happiness, I'm thinking that the joy that you have might override the dash of mycotoxins that might be in it. And if you want to get a cleaner cup of coffee, then there are plenty of companies out there that do the mycotoxin, you know, free certified coffee that you can play around with.
Is there one that you prefer that is more clean for the coffee?
You know, I have my own coffee snob habit here in Vermont, but I am not familiar with too many mycotoxin-free coffees. I know that, you know, the whole Bulletproof and Dave Asprey line promotes or used to promote a mycotoxin-free or low mycotoxin coffee, but I'm sure if people just give a good Google out there, they could probably find something. But be sure to check for a white paper or something that actually proves their quality standard testing.
That's a good point. Yeah. Well, thanks for giving me permission and the listeners permission to continue to drink our coffee, because I'm having at least a cup a day right now during the coronavirus quarantine. And, you know, I like that you say that if that gives us joy and that ritual is part of, you know, your morning routine, that you're not a big proponent of taking that away from people, because I think that a lot of what we see in this industry of natural medicine or functional medicine, integrative medicine, whatever you want to call it, is that a lot of these people that are very sick, that don't have a lot of joy or things to look forward to in their daily lives with chronic fatigue, et cetera, that cup of coffee may be the best part of their morning. So taking that away could be pretty rough, especially if that's just giving you enough energy to get out of bed and walk the dog or, you know, take the trash out, check the mail kind of things. So I think that's really well put. And I mean, going back to the topics of brain health and endocrine health with mold, what are you seeing in the medical literature around hormones and brain health and how these mold toxins are affecting people?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's one of the, you know, like I said, it's a cornerstone to my practice, the brain health component. To kind of take a step back and think about why the brain, like we already, you know, said that mycotoxins are lipophilic, you know, the research shows that they, you know, have been found in super high fat organs, like your liver, your nervous system, and also even stored in adipose tissue. And curiously enough, I think one of the biggest bum out study that I've read was a post-mortem analysis of kiddos, I think from some part of Africa, maybe Gambia, that consumed aflatoxin in their diet, and they found physical brain deposition on autopsy of aflatoxin in their brain, and also downstream metabolites of it. So, you know, that alone is a really big reminder that it doesn't have to be just inhalational, you know, orally just as well can cross into the blood-brain barrier. And how that really happens, is really mediated by our astrocytes. So maybe quick recap for people. Astrocytes are huge supporting cells for the nervous system. And they have these little feet that hang out on your small micro blood vessels that kick around on what we call your blood-brain barrier. And when these guys are disrupted, they also cause disruption in the endothelial lining. And so we've seen that plenty of mycotoxins are directly toxic to astrocytes, which then leads to downstream kind of like a leaky gut of the brain. You know, you get leaky vasculature, and then you see that these mycotoxins get deposited in the brain tissue. So we have that post-mortem analysis. We've also seen that systemic administration of things like T2, which is a trichophysine from kind of the scary stacky infamous black mold family of molds. We see that T2 with systemic administration can get through and alter the blood-brain barrier. So, you know, once they alter it, it's pretty easy for them to cross it. And other parts of research show that aflatoxin, ochratoxin, fumonisins, trichophysines, enantiums, they all have some type of ability to cross the blood-brain barrier. And so a lot of this research is kind of food-based and animal-based, but we need to keep in mind a lot of these molds that we do see growing on food can very well grow in an indoor, damp environment, you know? It happens. And so we see the huge alteration of the blood-brain barrier. And then one of the other things that's concerning is, you know, I hope some of the listeners here are aware that your olfactory bulb that hangs out in your nose has direct communication to the brain. And there's a good amount of research out there saying that that's essentially a superhighway for bugs. When I say bugs, I say viruses, bacteria, these things, to find their way into our nervous system. And so we've seen by the same right that intranasal exposure to certain mycotoxins can cause damage to that olfactory bulb in the nose, but then they can crawl up and elicit damage in the brain portion of the olfactory bulb. So when you're thinking about mycotoxins getting into the brain, it's happening through systemic administration through eating or breathing in. And then we're also seeing it happen through direct communication through our nerves that are in contact with the outside world. And you know, that's kind of the start of it. The effects of that are just, numerous. There's a lot of different brain regions that really suffer as a result of mycotoxin exposure.
So when I'm listening to you talk about that, I'm thinking about, you know, the Seattle area, which, you know, we both went to Bastyr University together. So we spent some time in King County area for years. And there's a lot of people that have encountered black mold there. And that's usually the mold that, you know, before anybody really knows anything about this, they've heard about maybe, you know, a couple of times. How and why is that the more, if you will, popular, most popular mold? Is it because it's more toxic or more prevalent or both?
Mm-hmm. So that's a good question. The first thing I'll mention is that there's a bit of a misnomer and catch-all phrase with the phrase black mold. There's lots of different molds that can be the color black. Aspergillus niger could be black, could also be green. Stachybotrys is the one that we all know as the infamous black mold. And that one is, the reason why it's so problematic is because of the mycotoxins that it produces. There are a couple of different strains that are more likely to be higher producers of mycotoxins, but the trichophysine group of mycotoxins that come from that type of mold have really been proven to be pretty problematic in people and animals.
Okay, thanks for that clarification. Because I think that in the layperson's world, they're, you know, calling it this one name. And as you distinguish, it can be a couple different molds. And it's good to know, maybe in the same vein, why is it good to know what molds are in your home? You know, why would you recommend someone get an inspection versus just saying like, oh, well, just do these therapies?
You know, there's something to be said about knowing too much about something versus knowing enough, right? So it can be really enlightening and really cool to know what types of molds are producing what. And depending on the clinical case, you know, someone might have a skeptical partner. Someone might have a skeptical family member. Someone might be fighting for some type of rental rights or job rights where we do need to say, hey, this Aspergillus fumigatus that was found in the home or XYZ is a producer of gliotoxin. And we see these elevations, you know, in their urine, or we see, you know, so that can be really helpful where it comes to identifying. The problem with testing is if you don't catch it, you don't get a positive. So, you know, there's a few different types of testing. There's air testing, there's ERMI, which is a DNA testing. They each have their benefits as to why would you use them, and they each have their reasons why they stink. But, you know, the ERMI is what I think can be really helpful for making the correlation for people between specific species and mycotoxin producers.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is helpful. And you also mentioned that if somebody's having issues with work or a renter, and I like that you mentioned that, because I think that people may be having these issues and they need somebody like you to connect the dots and say, hey, you know, this is in your home. This isn't all in your brain. You know, maybe it is in your brain actually, but it's not something you made up, you know, it's not all in your head, in quotations. So I think that's helpful for people to distinguish in, you know, when it is important to test and when not. Going back to the molds that affect brain health, and you said that there are particular parts of the brain that they affect. Are we seeing that these molds, beyond brain fog, what could be some of the long-term risk factors here? Dementia? Are we talking about dementia? Are we talking about Alzheimer's? What are we concerned about?
So that's a really good question, Sam. I think that when you're thinking about long-term exposure, the reality is we don't know with 100%. I find that kids usually recover quicker. I find that there are plenty of adults who don't go into a long-term chronic deficit. With that being said, that really depends on avoidance of exposure. We know, maybe some people are familiar with Dale Bredesen's work of inhalational Alzheimer's, that really coincides with mold exposure. And, you know, I'm not clear with that, if that is because they are being maintained in these spaces where they have chronic exposure that's not stopping. There has been a couple of cases that I've had where I've had some resistant cognitive deficits after we've kind of cleared out their system. But, you know, I think that that's where naturopathic medicine really shines through, is it doesn't stop at detox. It really continues into tonification of the systems and bringing them back online. But, you know, it's the concerns of the exposure are there. Like there's some studies that have shown that early exposure, postnatal exposure to kiddos placed them at a higher risk of having a lower IQ score, 3 times higher risk at having a lower IQ score. And also it increases the severity of the IQ deficit. You know, we know that in animal studies that something like ochratoxin A, which is found in foods and in the environment, down it regulates your NDMA receptors, which can cause issues with like learning and memory. We know that pimonacins in rats cause issues with your neurocortex, which can cause problems with informational processing. And then ochratoxin A in rats really seems to like to hang out in certain key parts of the brain. In particular, your hippocampus, your cerebellum, a few different parts of the brain that are really integral to navigating our world, you know. And one of the more curious ones that I've seen is T2 toxin, which is a trichothecene, seems to have a little bit of a target on the pituitary gland, which I think is pretty curious, you know, because that plays right into the HPA axis and all of that. So, there's definitely some changes that can be seen. And we know that there can be differences in like QEEGs with people that kind of coincide with abnormal cognitive testing. And we've also seen demyelination of like the forebrain in rats too with pimonacin. So there's a lot of stuff that, you know, is concerning with regards to the impact of specific brain areas for sure.
So in the future, we could be seeing more research, hopefully, into how some of these molds affect things like MS, Alzheimer's, potentially.
I'm hoping. There was a really interesting study that I've been trying to dig up for probably a few weeks now by a Polish author who had some initial findings of a connection between leukemia and exposure to a few different types of molds in leukemia households versus controls. And the research just hits a dead end, you know? So I'm hoping that people will jump on this and continue to carry the flag, because it's so important and it's so highly overlooked. And especially when you have these just ridiculing studies that come out just absolutely saying, you know, mold exposure is not a problem, toxic mold syndrome doesn't exist, it's not validated in the evidence, it's not all this. And it's just heart-wrenching, because while it's some of it might be true, we don't have double blind crossover randomized trials because that's unethical. You can't get an IRB to validate exposing kids legally to a mycotoxin to see what their brain does, you know? So I just have concerns that there's a lot of people who are combating the realities of mold exposure, and I want to know for what reason and why, because mm-hmm. clearly there's an issue here, you know?
Yeah, definitely. When people are blocking something that could be affecting a ton of people. And I think it was last year that Children's Hospital in Seattle Children's Hospital admitted they had a mold overgrowth issue in mm-hmm. the hospital. So that's concerning when you have sick children exposed to molds that can make them more sick in a hospital. And maybe they're there for, you know, a while because they have to be, or going back and forth to the hospital for their treatment. So that's a huge concern. As far as hormones, are you seeing a lot of people, a lot of men and women having low hormones, whether it's thyroid or adrenal hormones, reproductive hormones from mold toxins?
You know, I see one of the biggest problems that I see in my practice is usually centering around some type of euthyroid, Hashimoto's thyroiditis, where the TSH looks normal and maybe the T3 in relation to the reverse T3 is wonky, and then you pull their TPOs and it's, you know, over 1,300. I definitely see a good amount of that from the endocrine point of view. And, you know, there is something to be said about the direct cause of a low testosterone level is a little bit harder to pinpoint, but what I can say is a lot of the mycotoxins in general are estrogenic in nature. And we know that when that happens, you have your estrogen competing with testosterone. We also know that a lot of these mycotoxins, especially in the SIRS picture, cause issues with leptin resistance. When you have leptin resistance, you're going to have more truncal obesity. And then because of that, you're going to have more aromatase activity that's going to be chewing up the testosterone into estrogen. So it's not uncommon to see kind of the, does that make sense? Like the anti-testosterone effects through kind of skewed estrogen, estrogen mimicking issues.
Yeah, it does make sense. Yeah, so basically the molds are increasing the conversion of aromatase for testosterone to estrogens, and that can disrupt this whole testosterone-estrogen balance, which is really key for men's health and women's health the other way, estrogen-testosterone balance.
And one of the other ones too, though, there's actual direct estrogenic effects from zearalenone, and it is something that it's a mycotoxin that they use in, I think, South America as an anabolic growth hormone in cows and things like that. And so, you know, exposure to that can send an endocrine system totally out of whack and really push on kind of the more female hormone pathways. You know, some of the other things that we've seen kind of from an anti-testosterone effect is we know that the impact of mycotoxins can kind of interfere with testosterone's normal functioning, meaning that, like, we've seen problems with Leydig cells and sperm production with mycotoxin exposure in a lot of animal models. And we've also seen kind of the flip side, where testosterone could be helpful in these cases, because, you know, we've seen things like adrenal necrosis with T2 exposure in animals, that seems to be prevented or mitigated, by testosterone, being present. So, while there's not 100%, you know, mycotoxins interfere with testosterone or they're anti-androgenic, it tends to be more, they're more estrogenic with then competes and causes problems with testosterone balance in the body. And so I think that there can be really big implications for women and developing children on that front. You know, we know that mycotoxins have vertical transmission. They can go through breast milk. They can go through the cord blood and into the uterus. And we see a lot of early developmental issues with kids, including neural tube defects with mycotoxin exposure. We see kiddos who have been exposed in utero, have brain development issues later on, have neurocognitive defects later on, have even hormonal imbalances and growth defects, a lot of low birth weights, low height to age ratios. So, you know, that's concerning from kind of the women's health perspective. And then, like I said, we see a lot of issues around precocious periods, so early periods, early breast development with some of these mycotoxins in kiddos and even in some little boys too.
Yeah, that's very concerning, especially once you started saying that it's crossing through the breast milk and, you know, these things that are nutritive for the growth of a baby. So that is very concerning. And you also mentioned before going into the women's health and pediatric health,
that it affects male fertility, which has been on the decline for decades now.
Right.
And I do not hear many people talking about mold mycotoxins affecting male fertility and that being part of the picture. So somebody's listening out there, and I get a lot of men contacting me, you know, young, mostly healthy men saying, hey, you know, we're trying to have a family. We are going to do everything we can. What are the things we should look at? And they are definitely not looking at mold illness or mold exposure as being something that could be affecting them both for fertility. So that's very helpful. Yeah. And then estrogen dominance is just ubiquitous for both men and women already, it seems like.
Right.
So it's really making it worse.
Something to follow up on that too is, I think when we think of fertility, we think of egg and sperm, but then we also have to take into consideration of like miscarriages and carrying, you know, to term, because I think a lot of women and partners suffer really unfortunate losses that get kind of lumped into infertility. And, you know, like I was saying, we see connections to different mycotoxins to neural tube defects. And there's even been a study that showed a correlation that was proportional, and kind of the more mycotoxin, I think it was the fumonisin in this case, the more risk of neural defect, and it would go up and up and up, and then it would hit an abortifacient level. And the pregnancy would essentially terminate when it would hit that max level. And so you might have perfectly healthy eggs and you might have perfectly healthy sperm, and but what's happening, you know, in the diet and how is it being translated to the kid? I think that should also really be considered with fertility concerns for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. It seems like this, I mean, it's really good that you're specializing in this area and that people are getting this information today in the podcast, and you're putting out a lot of information out there on YouTube and social media, because I think that, as I mentioned in the beginning, a lot of, you know, the general public does not consider mold when they start considering, you know, their health symptoms that are why they go to the doctor, you know, fatigue being the number one that we usually see. Is that's not one of the things that usually comes up. And okay, has there been water damage in my home, or does my brain fog get worse when I'm at work or at home, you know, or whatever other situational symptoms that may come up for them, or do I get better when I go on vacation and things like that. And I really think that not enough people are taking this seriously. And you know, in Seattle area, we have people who go down to Palm Springs or Arizona for the winter and then they come back. Mm-hmm. And so that population may notice, hey, you know, I feel better when I'm in one home or the other because there's not water damage there, or there wasn't ever, or it's a newer home. So things for people, I think, listening to consider. And are there specific treatments that you recommend or don't recommend if, you know, people are hearing about things or they think they have mold toxicity already that they should avoid, or things that they should run towards more?
Let's see. Can I double back to one thing that you said?
Yeah, please do.
That ties in to this kind of conversation. It feels like we're about to have, you know, I feel like the horrible bearer of bad news. I feel like I have a giant gray cloud around me in this podcast. it's just that reminder of when people do go to their other home, like, and you feel better, like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. We just found out an awesome key point of your case. That's such a beautiful part of knowing, like, this not only gives us a hint on what to do, but it's also, there's hope. If you left your house for a week and you feel better, like, oh my gosh, that means your detox pathways are online. That means that you will and can get better. You probably just need a little bit of help and you need to get out of exposure. And so what I kind of want to take from that and kind of bring into this, to avoid any type of treatment it's not avoiding treatment that I worry about for people, because there's a lot of decent treatments out there. And, you know, I am part of a nonprofit that really focuses on teaching physicians the different ways of approaching mold illness. So I'm a big believer in there's more than one way to do this. What I want to kind of double back to is the fear component. You know, you can approach this in so many different ways, but if your treatment involves defensiveness and attack and fear, and you're really going to put yourself in a situation where treatment is going to be a lot harder, your limbic system's going to be activated. So rather than avoiding a treatment, it's more like avoiding a particular mindset that can happen when you start treatment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's helpful. It's definitely helpful, because I know out there we hear about, people talking about doing sauna therapy, and you mentioned glutathione and binders and that approach. So I just was curious in that, if you're seeing ways that therapies of people coming to you have already tried things that are exasperating their symptoms, or maybe they're detoxing too fast, or as you mentioned, their detox pathways aren't completely open, so that could send them down a bad response or an unwanted response for a period of time.
There are different treatment approaches for sure, and it really depends on the case. So if I have someone who happened to develop multiple chemical sensitivity at the same time as mold exposure, which happens a lot, and you know, they tend to be the people who can't bring on a new supplement without developing hives. Some can't drink water without developing hives. You know, those are going to be the cases that I tell people to do not follow any type of treatment that exists out there. There's a lot of preparatory work that has to happen. Don't jump on glutathione as the bandwagon. In fact, if I had my way, unless someone knows that they tolerate it well and they just have kind of a low level exposure, I'm not crazy about people blindly going on to glutathione. But then again, I also have really sensitive people that I see clinically.
Yeah, thanks for saying that. And with the diagnostics and treatments, I mean, we were talking about SIRS a lot during this show today. Mm-hmm. And I've talked with other people and patients and colleagues who talk about this genetic connection with mold and HLA. Can you discuss what exactly that is briefly? I mean, we don't need to go into a ton of detail, but there's the HLA, and some of these people are more sensitive or genetically sensitive to molds, it sounds like, and maybe extend on that, elaborate on that.
Sure. So once again, I was fully SIRS trained and certified, and I was pulling HLAs that, if they're not covered by insurance, run in $300 and $400 a pop. And what I was seeing clinically was that I had some people who had really bad cases of SIRS that didn't have any issues with their HLAs. I had people who had really bad HLAs with no SIRS. So HLA started to be less important for me clinically. And, you know, thankful to Paul Anderson and Ben Lynch and Amy Osko, you know, I've always had the like SNPs in the back of my head. And SNPs always made more sense to me than HLA. So HLA centers around antigen presentation. And it's when our body encounters something, it will pick up that specific antigen and show it to the rest of our cells. So I picture how I used to explain this to people is there'd be someone in the outfield and they would have a big glove on and they would, you know, grab the baseball out of the air, they'd catch it, and then they'd show it to their teammate and be like, this is it, I got it. So what ends up happening with HLA issues supposedly is that baseball mitt, what we call the MHC complex, it's like lubed up. It is oily and slick and slippery, and the outfielder keeps getting balls pitched to him, and he can't grab them and clear them. He can't grab them. So all of a sudden, you have an outfield full of all these balls that you can't clear, and you're twisting your ankle, you're slipping, you're falling. And so just like that, the immune system is also getting inundated with inflammation, inundated with exposure. It can't catch and clear. And so I just found that it wasn't as helpful as SNPs. You know, I think that there's a lot of great information that we can get from understanding what's happening, with someone's sulfur detox pathways, or what's happening with progranulation, or what's happening with their GSH and GST and all that kind of fun stuff. So I personally think that there is more of an application in the SNP realm than I do with the HLA. And it really seems to have aided my practice, especially when, you know, we actually have the information that, like, let's say, like, ochratoxin A gets degraded by your CYP254 or something like that. And if we have that information about how slow someone's CYP pathways are going, like, it makes more sense to me as a practitioner. And I think one of the other hard parts is we know we can turn our SNPs turn on and off, right? And if we had a fully non-functional SNP, you know, we'd essentially be dead. There is some functionality even with abnormality. So I think that people also understand that even if you have a funky SNP, it's not a death sentence. Versus with HLA, these terms of the dreaded gene, you have someone coming into you and they go, oh my God, I have the dreaded gene. I'm never going to recover. That's limbic system activation right there. That is fear. That is a self-fulfilling prophecy of their immune system's just not going to do its job. So I'm not a huge fan of HLA. And that's one of the things that we talk about in ICI. I think it's a good thing to be aware of. Some people find great clinical utility with it. I just haven't personally.
Thank you for that. Thanks for clearing that up for me and the audience. Because, I mean, I do talk to people here and there who are, they do say, you know, I have this genetic genotype or whatever for HLA and higher risk. And I think, you know, I agree with you. I agree with what you're saying. So I'm glad to hear you say that. And I always was kind of curious what people's take who were specializing in mold illness on this, because when we gravitate towards saying that we are our genetics and that is our destiny, I think we're in the old dogma still, as you're mentioning, you know, where SNPs can be, they're still somewhat functioning, as you mentioned, and there's still some, you know, there's hope and there's ways that we can nutritionally and natural medicine wise move those things through in a healthy way, where with the HLA camp, it's like, we're doomed, doom and gloom.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's hard to help people. As I was telling somebody the other day, at the risk of sounding harsh, it's really hard to help people, if not impossible, when they're a victim. So when we're a victim to our genetics, it's, you know, peeling those layers off, it's going to take a lot for people to say, okay, well, I can be helped. You know, I am able to heal. And one of the core principles of naturopathic medicine is the body can heal itself,
right?
Given what it needs, right? So, right. You know, our still point is health, not illness. And I think a lot of people have been stuck in illness so that they think that's their still point or their neutral zone. And it's hard for them to realize or come to a new framework of actually your body was built to idle in health and healing. So yeah, it's really revolutionary to hear that in the mold world, that HLA is not something that you did a lot of work with, but now you have moved away from that. And that is very valuable wisdom for people to hear today.
Yeah, and I have to say, you know, Doc, it's really cool. I think in all the people that I've been interviewed by so far, I haven't had the opportunity to sit and chat with a fellow naturopath. And you're like, right, someone else out there has those core foundations to their practice, that there is a mind-body medicine component. And, you know, in going through the primary care stuff when I first got out, it's, you get so separated from that. And then suddenly you come back to it and you're like, oh, right, limbic system activation. Oh, right, you know, somatic experiencing, like polyvagal theory, right? It's all there. So it's just really also refreshing to sit with another naturopath and be reminded that this is our medicine and this is how we were taught. And this is a beautiful thing. It's a good thing.
Amen to that. It is really a beautiful thing. And I think the world is, you know, it's like a second wave of the naturopathic medicine revolution, or the 100th wave. Who knows how many waves there have been throughout the last 300 years. But
right.
People are, you know, they want this medicine. They're excited to have this medicine. They want root cause medicine. They want to be healthy. They're tired of being told that they basically have to take a lot of medications and that's all that they have to look forward to. And they're really excited and passionate about, okay, well, what can I do to optimize my health? What can I do to be my best? And what does that look like? And they may not know that it's called naturopathic medicine yet, but they know that they want something different and that there is hope there, where there's not a lot of hope when they're told, okay, well, you have to take this medicine and, you know, you have these genetics and you're basically screwed. Good luck. And, you know, I think that's why men don't like, without getting on a long tangent, don't like to go to the doctors, because they're told, you know, you're kind of screwed. And you got to keep taking this medicine and that's all we have for you. And then surgery. So that scares people away, versus this approach is a collaborative approach. So where can people find you? I know you have your YouTube and Instagram. What are your accounts for the Instagram and website?
Yeah, easy enough. My handles on Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram. They're all Life After Mold. So pretty simple. And my website itself is Life After Mold. I have a little free e-booklet for people for mold prevention. It's called Mold Prevention 101. It gives you the rundown on how to really protect your home or get a grasp of what the issues in your home could be. And then monthly, I've been trying to put out kind of YouTube videos. I've put out one about the connection with multiple chemical sensitivity, four things that you can do to keep yourself in mold remission. And so, yeah, I'm working on kind of cranking out content for people to the best of my ability.
So. Awesome. Thanks so much for doing that. And thanks for being on the show today, and look forward to connecting more with you in the future. Everybody, this was Dr. Lauren Tessier, and please share the podcast with friends and family. We'll see you next time. Now, here's for my mandatory disclaimer. This is a medical information podcast and is only for general information purposes. It does not substitute or constitute the practice of medicine or any medical practices, including the giving of medical advice to any individual. And please observe that no doctor-patient relationship has been formed here. This medical podcast offers health, hormone, fitness, and nutrition information and is designed for educational purposes only. You should not rely on this information as a substitution for, nor does it replace professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you have any concerns or questions about your health, you should always consult with a physician or other healthcare professional. Do not disregard, avoid, or delay obtaining medical or health-related advice and appropriate treatment from your healthcare professional. Users should seek the care of their physician or healthcare professional for any such conditions. The use of any information provided on this podcast is solely at your own risk. The contents and topics of this podcast have not been evaluated by the FDA nor approved by any other government or official body. The topics and content covered is not intended to diagnose, cure, or prevent any disease or disorder of any kind.
developments in medical research may impact the health, fitness, and nutritional advice that appears here on the podcast in the future episodes. No assurance can be given that the advice contained in this podcast will always include the most recent findings or developments in medicine with respect to the particular material covered. If you are in the United States and think you are having a medical or health emergency, call your healthcare professional or 911 immediately. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to hearing your feedback and looking forward to have you on future podcasts. Thank you.